The Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, June 4th, 2003, and we will be in work session on House Bill 5021, the Department of Higher Education Operations Budget. Mr. Bender, could you bring us up to date on the paper we have in front of us and take us through the issues that we will be covering today?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This will be the wrap-up day for this portion of the higher ed work session. And I would just like to indicate or let you know of some materials that have been distributed to you this morning. There are two materials. One is a letter from the Oregon Student Association that they would ask you to look at and be entered into the record relating to expectations on implementing the RAM, on operating the RAM during this upcoming biennium. Another item that should be immediately below your agenda. These were placed in the order that we do intend to go through them. Is a statement from the Joint Boards of Education, the State Board of Education, which has which oversees state policies for community colleges, and the State Board of Higher Education, which oversees state policies on for the Oregon University System, do meet together on a regular basis to discuss and review issues of concern to both systems. And they have issued a statement here that the department has asked to be distributed and entered into the record relating to their commitment to quality in both systems. And I believe that I haven't really been able to look through this, but I do believe that the gist of what they're saying is that enrollments may need to be limited in order to maintain quality in the systems.
And there also appears to be a statement here that says that if a campus chooses to enroll additional students on the margin, that the institution will do what it has to do to assure quality.
What does that mean?
Are you, I'm sorry.
I'm talking about the
Okay. Yes, well, I think this is recognition that students, that campuses will not be receiving additional general fund for student enrollment under the plan principles for RAM distribution next biennium, and that as they accept students on a tuition-only basis in terms of the revenue that they're receiving, that there's an expectation that the institutions do not allow the quality of the services to deteriorate simply because the funding, the additional funding per student, it does not include a general fund component. So I think they're calling institutions to be accountable to maintaining their quality as they make decisions to enroll students on a tuition-only basis.
And I see heads nodding up and down out there in the audience. Questions or comments on either of these two pieces of information that we've received?
Madam Chair.
Representative March.
Well, I think that the heads nodding, there also were some scowls out there, particularly with regard to the RAM model and enrollment caps.
I think, Representative, that we have discussed in great length the stress that the fiscal situation that the state faces puts on the RAM model and the challenges that the system faces as a result of that. And I think that it is very positive that they're acknowledging that they will do what they need to do to maintain the quality of the system. Mr. Bender, could you please continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item in your packet of materials that should have been immediately behind the joint board statement is an item that LFO has distributed to you titled DHED, Department of Higher Education Budget Notes. And what I've done here is, for your convenience, I've put all of the budget notes on one page. On the front page here, these are budget notes that you've already voted to adopt. So this is just a repetition here. On the back, though, of this page, LFO is recommending that you consider and adopt the following three budget notes as well. So with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll start going into those and explaining what those are.
Okay, but let it be noted for the record that because of the obvious absence of a certain party on this committee, we won't be moving any of these today. Please proceed.
The first budget note deals with tuition and fees, and as we've been looking at the budgets of the institutions and of the system, it's become very clear that tuition and fee revenues are such a significant component of university and system operating budgets that it is LFO recommends that this body clarify to higher ed certain understandings that you have related to the tuition and fee rates and revenues that you're anticipating in this budget when you eventually approve it. A couple things to note very briefly again is that the control that the legislature has over tuition and fee rates is as follows. By law, the State Board of Higher Education is the body that establishes or sets tuition and fee rates. So you are not acting to establish any tuition or fee rates. And you would essentially require a bill if you wanted to change the current law that has the State Board of Higher Ed doing that, and we're not recommending that. So the State Board of Higher Ed would set tuition and fees, but note that where the legislature has more direct involvement in this or an absolute involvement in this is you determine indirectly how much they can spend from the tuition and fees that they're generating by providing a limitation or by choosing a limitation on their expenditures in the education in general program. So in other words, the system could pick any type of tuition rates it wants to or the board chooses to, but they may not be able to spend all of the money that they would generate if you limit those expenditures to a level that is less than what the tuition and fees are projected to generate. So in order to deal with this somewhat awkward situation, this is what LFO would recommend that you include in your budget as a explanation in a budget note. And I will read this because it is a bit complicated. The legislatively adopted budget accommodates expenditures in the education and general limited budget of net tuition and fee revenues totaling, and then there will be some dollar amount. So this will make it clear how much tuition and fee revenue expenditures supported by tuition and fees you are approving. The reason why we are recommending this in the budget report is that the actual limitation that goes in law does include a few non-fee revenue sources in it. So this is sort of like a sub discussion of part of that limitation and what it amounts to. This total is estimated to accommodate net tuition revenue under the enrollment projections the department reported to the subcommittee, given annual tuition rate increases for resident undergraduates. Resident, of course, is the Oregon students, resident undergraduate students that average some percentage, we can't fill these numbers in yet, on a system-wide basis over spring 2003 rates for essentially the first academic year and some other percent on a system-wide basis for the second academic year. So what we're proposing to do is we are proposing that LFO will, after we get more information as to any revisions that there may be in the amount of state funding that would be available to support education in general in this budget, we will work with the staff of higher ed to make sure these numbers are consistent with each other, but essentially we will have some type of tuition increase amounts and a dollar amount of expenditures that accurately reflects the best projection of what those tuition increase amounts should generate for the system. This is very similar to what was done last biennium. Last biennium, there was a budget note of a slightly different structure, but essentially that budget note said that we expect tuition rates to be equal, you know, tuition rates to be increases to be 4% the first year of the biennium, 3% the second year of the biennium, and we calculated the other funds limitation based on how much that should have raised. And of course, things changed a lot last session because this biennium because of the budget shortfalls. But that's the basic idea. So again, we're asking you to do something of that manner with one set of tuition increases for resident undergrads, to then continue on the dollar totals, also accommodate average system-wide tuition rate increases for everyone else, for all other categories of students, of so much in the first year and so much in the second year. So it's potential that those rate increases would be different. Then total revenues from resource and other mandatory enrollment fees in the education and general limited budget are projected to increase by no more than some percent over the 2001-02 biennium. So these are the non-tuition fees that also support these expenditures. So what we will be doing is, if you approve this budget note in structure and concept, and I guess you're not going to be taking a vote on it today anyway, but if this is a structure that makes sense to you, when we come back for our final work session, we will have recommendations for all the X's and the Y's and the Z's, you know, a certain percentage rate. The second paragraph of this budget note says, the department shall report to the emergency board or to the legislative assembly on any tuition and fee increases approved by the State Board of Higher Education that exceed these expectations. This report shall be made in a timely manner and prior, if possible, to the time such tuition and fee increases are first imposed. So again, the legislature and certainly the emergency board during the interim does not have authority to approve or disapprove of tuition rate increases. That's not one of the e-board authorities. But we are requiring, this note would require, that if tuition and fee increases exceed these levels, that they report this to the emergency board before they actually impose the fee increases.
Questions or comments? Representative March.
I was looking at the material you had gave us yesterday, Steve, on page 2, where the universities have proposed the various tuition increases, and for basically 03-04, they range from 0 to 8%.
Yes.
And in 04-05, they range from 5 to 12%. And are you envisioning, in essence, adopting those proposed numbers and calculating backwards from that, or are you envisioning another cap situation which would in some ways maybe adversely affect people who kept their tuition increases lower the first year than the second?
This your question raises a number of issues, and I think they can all be categorized as relating to the fact that the campus tuition proposals are quite different from each other. There's a lot of variability in the types of increases that are being proposed, and this is a change from the way things were done in the past. I mean, they've been moving toward this, and this is far more extreme, if I may, in terms of the variation between campuses than we've seen in the past. And it makes it more difficult, frankly, to talk about what the tuition rate increases would be. The way that this budget note is envisioned and the way we believe it would work is it would be looking at the total, for example, for resident undergraduates, we would basically be looking at the total amount that we would expect to generate at the projections, enrollment projections we have, and comparing that total amount to those enrollments to the amounts that would have been generated at those same enrollment levels with no tuition increase, and then compared to whatever this number is. So what we're essentially doing is we're looking at, on a system-wide basis, if you adopt this budget note, you'd be looking at system-wide basis at how much students in total are being expected to contribute for their education services, but it would still remain up to the institution, to the system, to establish tuition rates that within that level do not exceed the total. So I do think that this could clearly, there'll be some issues here among the institutions that you're raising, and they will have to convince the board of the best way to operate within a total limitation increase. But we're not trying to limit. What this would not do is it would not say, if it turned out that the number that you ended up picking was an 8% increase in 1 year, the way this is written, it does not say that no campus is unable to increase this by more than 8%. What it does say is, if we look at the overall structure of tuition increases, if it's equivalent to, given where the students are projected to be enrolled, a more than 8% increase, it's like a weighted average, then they can still do it because they have the right to set their tuition rates, but they will have to report that to the emergency board.
It's almost like I wouldn't mind seeing some numbers projected out to see what this results in. I mean, it's sort of like, if we're just throwing out a percentage figure and we don't know what it does, in effect, then it's not good public policy.
Do we have the enrollment projections at this point?
Yes, we do have enrollment projections that were used essentially to create the information that we looked at yesterday, which was saying, well, how much tuition do we expect at the governor's rates of tuition rate increases, or at these rates on the sheet. And in order to get those total numbers, those were based on enrollment projections at each of the seven campuses.
Okay. Now, Representative March, talk to me again about what you're needing to get here.
Well, what I'm worried about is if an institution has tried to keep their increases relatively low, are they going to get artificially hurt by some sort of adjustment here? And then conversely, somebody who's expecting to raise a certain amount, are they going to be capped to where they can't can't afford to operate? So basically, what is this going to result in tuition amounts raised to spend per institution?
I think that what it is, and please correct me if I'm not correct in my assumptions here, Mr. Bender, but this is an attempt to quantify what the system is proposing to do with tuition for the purpose of establishing an expenditure limitation for the system.
Mm-hmm.
The second paragraph of this is the escape clause, essentially. If we get into a situation where things don't go according to the way the projections are, there's a way to correct it. Mr. Bender?
Yes, I would agree. The only modification is that I would make to what you had said, Madam Chair, is that the percentages that you adopt may or may not in the end being the equivalent to what these would be equivalent to, the proposed ones were. That would be a policy decision for you to make. In the event that if you believe that the funding situation is sufficient, that these types of proposed tuition and rate increases are not needed by the department in the sense that you would prefer to have lower tuition rate increases given the amount of funding available, then I believe, Representative Marsh, that your the answer to your question, frankly, would be we wouldn't know exactly how each individual campus would be impacted on a campus by campus basis, because that would be up to the remain up to the decision of the state board. We would just know in total, when we look at the total system, how much we're expecting students to contribute and how much we're expecting the state to contribute.
Okay. I'll have to think about this a little more. Thank you.
Further comments, Senator Mesley? Representative Smith?
No. I'm going to reserve any comment until I know what those increases are going to be. It's hard for me to engage in a conversation when there's a big unknown out there.
Shall we move ahead then?
Okay. The next budget note that we suggest you approve deals with fee remissions. And before I even want started on this, I do want to clarify that this budget note is not dependent upon the item in the co-chair's budget that includes a reduction in fee remissions. So in other words, we would recommend this whether or not there's any such provision in the legislatively adopted budget. What this, the fee remissions report budget note just does is, along with the tuition and fees one above it, it's designed to clarify what the expectation in this budget is for other fund revenues, how much you expect them to be available to help support the costs of the Oregon University system. What this budget note would read is as follows. The legislatively adopted budget includes so many, you know, some level of fee remissions. And obviously, if you adopted or did approve some kind of provision to reduce the amount of fee remissions, such as is in the co-chair's budget, which we will discuss a little bit later, that would affect what that number would be. So that's why it's blank at this point. But it's just to say you're going to specify how much you're expecting in fee remissions and how that total breaks down between the programmatic fee remissions and the graduate fee remissions. So the sum of those two would be the number in the first sentence. Then it says that the department will limit fee remission awards to these levels, and campuses will not enter into commitments for fee remissions in excess of these totals unless total enrollment exceeds enrollment projections the department reported to the subcommittee, and the intent to award fee remissions in excess of these amounts is reported to the emergency board or legislative assembly before the fee remission awards are committed. Last session, that's to say during the current biennium, there were actual other funds expenditure limitations on fee remissions. So you did put a limit in, and there really wasn't a need for a budget note. This session, because of the changes in the government accounting standards, the fee remissions are not, or at least the programmatic fee remissions, are not being counted as expenditures anymore. Since they're not expenditures, you can't put an expenditure limit on them in law. This budget note would instead direct the department to the department what you're expecting the fee remissions to be. Therefore, what you expect indirectly, how much money they'll have after these fee remissions to support the operating costs of the institutions. It does say, though, that if the enrollment is greater than projected, you do understand that they would presumably wish to award more fee remissions than was projected, but you would ask them to report on that to you so you know that that's happening.
Questions or comments? Problems, disagreements, issues? More coffee, perhaps?
Since I've been had this mental change from the health problems to this problem now, I have to take a second to readjust my brain.
Well, let me take a minute to point out that coffee service has been restored to the committee. So, oh,
thank you, Lord. Yes.
In fact, I'm going to get some. You want some?
Yeah. Just bring the pot over here.
Okay.
What's the OUS position on this? Have they discussed it?
They have not discussed this here. We did let them. They have seen these, so they may be prepared to make some comments.
Please come forward. And I think probably what I should have done in retrospect is to bring you up to get your reaction to the tuition and fees budget note too, Mr. Enders. So if you'd care to comment on that one first, that would be appropriate.
Tom Andrews, Senior Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration with the Oregon University System. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the basic concept on the tuition and fees makes sense. How that breaks out, I think, in responding to what Representative March had mentioned, we need to work through the kind of the logistics or the structure. Mr. Bender and I have had a conversation regarding the averaging concept, looking at, you know, if you're 0 to 8 and let's say it's 4%, it turns out to be 4% as an average. My assumption would be that if you're in the range of 0 to 4% or 0 to 3%, you could be increasing your rate. Now, and if you're beyond that, if you're at 5, 6, 7, and 8, you can increase it. The first portion would be increasing it without necessarily having to go to the E board for the rate increase. If you're beyond that 4% threshold, you would literally be going to the E board and saying, I would want to increase my rate to, you know, an extra 2%. And in both cases, if there is additional expenditure limitation that's necessary, that would go to the E board as well. That's just a quick reading of kind of our initial discussion. So if an institution is below that threshold, then they would have the capacity or the capability to do that without going to the e-board, at least for the rate increase, but not necessarily for the expenditure limitation. That might have to go forward.
So in terms of being a workable way to achieve the balance between legislative oversight on the total amount of the expenditure and the system's ability to juggle the needs of the campuses, do you think that this is a workable approach?
Madam Chair, short of trying to deal with each institution separately and saying, okay, when this institution goes beyond the 3% it projected, I think this does make a lot more sense. I think the net effect will not be much different, because if we stick right now, the numbers that you've seen that the board has approved for 04 and going into 05, they may change. But I'm guessing they're relatively solid unless there's other general fund issues that come up. But if they do change, they're going to change a little bit here, a little bit there, and they'll probably have to come forward anyway. So, no, I think this is a solution that we can work through.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Enders from the members of the committee on the proposed tuition and fees budget note? Representative Smith.
What are the board's recommendations for fee increases for 0304?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, they are the ones Mr. Bender had handed out a chart, and those are, when you look at 04 and 05, those are exactly what the board had recommended.
Got it.
Let's go ahead then, and if you could talk to us about the fee remission budget note from the perspective of the OUS system.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this seems to be a reasonable approach. What you're suggesting is that when there is an understanding of where the general fund is, where the tuition dollars are, that we should then be able to come to an agreement as to what the fee remissions will be. And I'm not sure how we could disagree with that. I mean, obviously, there will be a point at which there may be a change. I think Mr. Bender has mentioned if there is additional enrollments, that can have an impact on fee remissions. But from the basic concept that when we've come to an agreement on the general fund and the tuition, there is no reason why we can't set our fee remission levels as well, both for the programmatic and for the graduate.
Representative Bates, do you have issues you wanted to discuss here?
Not really at this point. I'm still concerned about the breakdown of those fee remissions, and that we focus on in-state students, resident students, who are either from a point of view of cultural diversity or who are low-income students, that's where those remissions should be focused on. We've done that in the past, and we would ask you to continue to do that. That's my major issue there. I still have concerns about attracting students by sort of bribing them into the system versus other states with fee remissions, and I'd like to see that policy curtailed as much as possible, knowing that that does bring in more money. But that's sort of a race to the bottom amongst the Western states, and I'd sure like to see that in. You've assured me that will be a discussion at a multi-state level in the near future. That would be, I think, very helpful and reassure me that the money that's being raised in the states for freedom emissions goes to the right area.
Sure.
Representative March, did you have any comments or questions for Mr. Anders?
Not this time.
Thanks. Okay. Let's go ahead then and talk about the resource allocation model distribution. You might want to just stay there.
Or you may not just want to stay.
That's what I was thinking.
On the other hand, Mr. Bender.
We had a discussion in subcommittee yesterday about the proposals for distributing general fund among campuses that the board has proposed, the method or the principles that the board has adopted to distribute the general fund appropriation to campuses during the 2003-2005 biennium. And we further talked about certain modifications in the RAM model that are being proposed for the upcoming biennium. We recommend acknowledgement of receipt of that information and basically to let the department know that you're expecting them to follow the principles that they've indicated to you and to report in instances where they need to make adjustments. So this is what the language would say, and this also, much of this budget note language parallels a budget note that was adopted for the 2001-2003 biennium. But this would say that the subcommittee acknowledges receipt of a statement of principles of RAM funding for the 2003-2005 biennium. I'm sorry. Oh, no, that is the right. Yeah, that's the right biennium. The subcommittee expects that general fund will be distributed in accord with these principles. If the Department of Higher Education makes substantial changes to these principles, it shall report on all substantial adjustments made to the resource allocation model and identify the fiscal impact to each campus and to centralized Oregon University system operations of each change. The department shall present a report on 2003-04 academic year adjustments to the emergency board no later than December 2003 and present a report on 2004-05 academic year adjustments and any prior year adjustments approved after the December report to the emergency board no later than September 2005. These reports may exclude adjustments made to correct errors or data or projections. Essentially, the second half of that budget note is the same language that was in the budget report for the 2001-03 budget. And the reason why we would suggest that you consider this budget note is you're looking at information and you're getting information that gives you some confidence as to how various institutional campus budgets will be affected by the budget that you're voting on. And if there are going to be some kind of changes, if they make a change that affects a particular institution, you want them to report to you on that.
Questions or comments on the budget note? Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, this is something that I was concerned about, as you know. And this, for me, this does two things. One, it does ask you to tell us of any significant change in policy as far as the RAM model is concerned. We're not really interested in technical adjustments and corrections. We understand that. It also opens it up for discussion at several episodes of episodic times to say, is the RAM model doing what we want to do? Let's re-examine those principles and have a chance for legislative oversight. It's through the e-board, and I expect that the next time that we're back in session, full session, that the RAM model may be looked at that time, too.
Sure.
It was set in place, in 99, I believe, and it's a significant change in how we've been funding ourselves as far as higher ed is concerned. I think legislative oversight and an opportunity to look at that RAM model and make certain those principles still hold for what we want out of higher ed is important. This gives us a chance to do that at least in two episodes, and then a more careful look possibly the next time Education Committee is set up and runs in the next session. So I fully support this as a reasonable request. I'm not sure how I or Ed felt, by the way, we talked about it. You're comfortable with it, too?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you for the budget note.
Further comments or questions? Mr. Anders, from the perspective of OUS, please.
Madam Chair, this is very much what we went through last time in terms of a budget note, and we think it's very reasonable. Given the discussion that we had yesterday, and I think what Representative Bates has just mentioned, there are concerns and or issues about how the model works and under what conditions they work or don't work well and small versus large and so forth. I think those are things that we really have to begin looking at right now as a system and look at with each of the campuses. We have been looking at the cell values. We've been looking at targeted programs. We've been doing a variety of things. But I think we need to do that now in preparation, I think, Representative Bates, for further discussions with the governor and the legislature.
I would concur both with Representative Bates and with Mr. Anders that it has been very interesting over the course of our discussions with the university system to take a look at the challenges that the RAM model is facing. And we had an interesting discussion yesterday about the different challenges that the system faces in a rising general fund revenue environment than the challenges that it faces in a falling general fund environment. And there appears to be significant issues related to the smaller, more isolated campuses being able to function inside of the model. And I do also agree that we have a continuing opportunity here to recognize that this is a work in progress and that there will always be opportunities to make it work better in the situations that we find ourselves applying it. And I would just hope that the discussion goes forward in a kind of an open-ended way that attempts to enrich the model and make it work better, and that the discussion be maintained around the health of the whole system.
Madam Chair, just an observation, and this doesn't directly tie to that, but maybe it doesn't even indirectly tie to it. But in your one budget note on administration, there is a good deal of discussion about the kinds of things and the services, efficiency of operation, duplication. And I'm not sure that there is an absolute linkage there, because perhaps this is more of a policy direction than anything else. But as we are working with the Legislative Fiscal Office, as we're working with the governor's office and Bill McGee, there may be ways of beginning to look at not only the kind of the structural organizational pieces of what we do with the campuses, but in this regard, as we're talking about looking at the model, perhaps having more of a discussion with them at that time as well. I'm not necessarily looking to expand that, but it just seems as though we do not have a lot of contact, as an example, with LFO, unless there's a very specific budget note. I mean, we'll talk, we look at a lot of issues, but given, I think, the goal and the direction to look at the model and to have more of an understanding of what it means well in advance of when the legislature meets again, that may be an opportunity to at least begin the dialogue.
I agree, and I think that in the global sense that the more discussion there is around these issues in advance of the time that we find ourselves in these rooms trying to crunch budgets together, the better people's understanding are going to be on both sides of this equation. And I'm always in favor of mixing people up as often as possible and bringing the issues to the table and having a discussion on them. And in defense of LFO, I would urge you to hang out with these guys. They're nice folks.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bender has been excellent and under very trying times these last couple of years, not only with the model, but all of the various things that have been happening in OUS and, you know, everything that you're all aware of. So it probably, if we would have tried to do something in the last year and a half, we wouldn't have been able to do it anyway, of any continuity at least.
These are challenging times.
Yes.
If there is no discussion, no further discussion on the budget notes, then let's move on to a discussion of the reserve funds.
Mm-hmm. There are two items that are that are available to you to look at the situation of OUS's reserve funds, fund balances. One is a large table on legal size paper. And the other is a sort of a summary right behind that. And I'd like to just start with the summary very quickly, just to talk about the structure of the fund balances that are held in the Oregon University system and the levels. And then we can hear from the department as to their interpretation of the adequacy of these funds. But I just want to point out before we start that there are many different types of funds in the system. And the funds are not fungible with each other. They cannot, in most cases, be transferred by the system from one fund to another. The largest fund is what I'm just calling the Education in General Fund. And actually, these consist of funds that are held both centrally at the chancellor's office level and by the campuses. What these funds consist of is they consist of the tuition and fee revenues and the other revenues in the education and general limited budget.
So, Mr. Bender, if I might interrupt, the proceeds in the fund or the balance in the fund resides both at the chancellor's office and on the campuses?
There are separate funds that the campuses have and that the chancellor's office would have. Okay. Now, typically, the chancellor's office funds, I don't believe there would be any tuition in those at this point because they don't get tuition and student fee revenues. But there are certain centralized funds available at the chancellor's office level as well.
Okay.
What these funds are used for is they're used to support the education in general program, which is, of course, the education services of higher ed. And these funds from the revenue sources that generate these balances are combined with general fund. And that's how you finance the education in general program. It's projected that when the new biennium starts in a few weeks, that if you added up all these various funds at the campuses and centrally, that they would total $73 million. And it is also projected that at the governor's balanced budget level of funding, by the end of this upcoming biennium, these balances would have risen to $111 million. I think it will be important to hear from the agency as to the types of assumptions that are being made that would lead to a conclusion that the fund balances will be increasing over the biennium and how robust this type of prediction is and to what extent it may be uncertain. But what this is basically showing is that under the governor's balanced budget, we would expect campuses and the central system to be able to increase their fund balance at that level of funding over the next biennium.
And if, Mr. Bender, the funding stream that fuels the accounts are solely tuition and fees. This does not also hold the general fund component from the state?
Technically, there is no general fund that is held or included in these amounts, but to the extent that the institutions are combining general fund and these tuition and fee balances together to finance their programs, if, for example, they have a certain amount of costs and there's more general fund available, then there would be more funds that could be left over at the end of the biennium and remaining in the fund balance.
Okay.
But the funds themselves are not general fund. The amount of general fund, though, clearly affects the ability of the institutions to maintain these fund balances at the levels where they are.
So would it be fair to say then that another factor influencing the levels in the fund would be the amount of tuition that is collected in terms of the number of students that are enrolled.
Yes.
Senator Mazzarin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I understand that aspect, but I don't have a good sense if the end of the fiscal year is the low point of their reserves, and because I would imagine they have ongoing costs through the summer with low tuition coming in and those kind of things. So at some point, could we have an update on or some information on that?
Maybe one thing that we need to bear in mind here is that the fiscal year ends at the end of June. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Anders, could you address Senator Mazzarin's issue?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Mike Green to come up and provide a little bit more of the technical background. I think we need to go through kind of a number of general reasons for both why the reserves have grown and how we would be using those, how we view that. But let me ask Mike to speak a little bit, I think, to Senator Mazzarin's.
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Mike Green. I'm the controller for the Oregon University System. Senator Mazzarin, the balances are a combination of, throughout the year, a combination of tuition and of general fund appropriation. We file an allotment plan with the governor's office to pull down our appropriation money in somewhat of an inverse relationship to tuition. So in July, we'll pull down a fairly large portion of our appropriation dollars to support those months, July, August, and September, when we don't have tuition dollars. So to say that the low point would be probably July, August, and September, it would be certainly for tuition dollars. But since they're combined, the low point, I have to look, but it's probably not much lower than $73 million at a point in time.
So just for my personal clarification, am I hearing you say that the general fund appropriation is a part of this? Or it is just a part of it in the sense that there's a balance between the two?
It's just a part of it in that we, for cash flow purposes, have to schedule our allotment of general fund dollars, but by the end of the biennium, general fund dollars are spent, and what's left is tuition dollars.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not quite sure I follow why there's tuition money left, not general fund money left, playing separate, but it's probably a wash.
Very valuable. I think it's a good place to go with the question.
Now, that would be one question. The other question I have is, and it's an assumption on my part that may be incorrect, I would expect that your biggest cost in the system is probably salaries and personnel, and that most institutions now pay on an annual basis, pay the same amount every month, so your costs don't drop dramatically during the summer, and you still run some programs during that time also. But if that's wrong, it would help me in my mind looking at these budgets. I expect you do have a decrease in June, July, and August, but I would guess it's not real dramatic because you're probably paying on an annual basis, not in a situation where you're paying just while the teachers and instructors and professors are actually in the institution. That incorrect or correct assumption?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's a correct assumption. We have we have a fair number of nine-month contracts, so the faculty on nine-month contract. Some of them choose to go pay their 9 months over 12 months, so those are spread out through the summer months. We do see a decline in the summer months, but not, I mean, I think it's like 85% of our budget is, or of that budget is salaries and wages or personnel costs, and during the summer months it does not decline a great deal.
The follow-up question, obviously, is the question of how you separate general fund money from tuition money. You end up with ending balance only tuition. I don't follow the reasoning there. So maybe you can flesh that out for me, because I mean, if you just spend one before you spend the other, it's all coming from the same pot.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's the that's correct. They are commingled, but that's the assumption we've been operating under for a number of years. Is that as the money flows in, we pull in appropriation dollars at a upfront loaded basis, and then at the end of the year, end of the biennium, that appropriation dollars are spent.
Well, then I think it also leads us to the question of, if you have spent down the general fund appropriation dollars, but the projected ending balance in the fund is increasing, then is there a discussion that needs to be had around the tuition levels being set so that the ending balance doesn't increase? Or I think conversely, the issue or the discussion may need to be where the prudent range is on the ending balances. And I notice in the spreadsheet that we were given that you suggest a 10% to 15% range, that the $73 million that's reflected there is 11%. And so I'm wondering where the $111 million puts you on a percentage basis.
Madam Chair, the $111 million we have to work through, because I understand, you know, how that was derived, but we have some concerns about how that particular it's built off the governor's budget, so we're not certain that that's really where that we're going to end up with 111. But assuming we did end up with 111, there's a couple of things that I think are really important. First of all, there has been a lot of growth in terms of enrollments, and that more than anything has contributed to the growing amount of dollars in tuition generally, and obviously then contributing to the fund balances, particularly since about 2000-2001. Right at about the time that the model was implemented, shortly thereafter, there's just been a real growth, and that's what leads to the fund balances growing. They grow in part because they're also going to be contributing to the expenditures, but over the last two years, we've been looking at very severe restrictions in not only general fund reductions, but tuitions have been under control as well. There's like this concern with the special sessions that if there is an issue that one can't handle with the general fund, or if there is an inability to deal with some set of reductions over a long haul, the only place we would have to go is to those fund balances. And even the fund balances are temporary. They can only be a solution for a point in time. So they have grown, and one would expect, why would you grow when there's a declining period of time with the general fund? The reality is people have put controls on, and we've had a lot of growth in enrollment. Now, I think the question of amount, 111, 100 million, 73 million, what does that mean? One of the points that's part of the discussion here is cash flow. And we are looking at an average expenditure every month of about $54 million. And that's literally something we can just count on. If you begin to look at the usable dollar within the reserve, I mean, the $111 million is a reserve, but in reality, there's many, many commitments against that. It's not an available balance that can be simply put over on the side not to be used. So you then bring down your reserve anywhere from the $100 million down to $50 million on the kind of the cash flow. And that's what you're then looking at, variously placed on the campuses in terms of their margin to look at additional general fund reductions. One of the things that I've talked to you a great deal about and where it goes, I don't know, but PEB. If we have to sustain any increased costs through PEB, our assumption is that we won't be receiving the funds through the general fund. And even if we do, there's still tuition-funded activities that are going to have to support that. So this would likely be a resource to have to handle that. But a big part of our, I think, the mentality that we have on the campuses is very much into control. It's very much into limiting what we're doing, and that has thus, I think, created the growing fund balances.
Given that we are in some very uncertain times here, and that the PEB growth rates are very shortly going to be known, I mean, we have some kind of preliminary numbers right now, that this represents an increase in that ending balance of over 50%. I mean, that's a substantial run-up in the money that ends up being put in here that's generated from increases in tuition and fees. And so I think that the discussion that needs to take place in the committee is over whether the run-up in the ending balance is indeed a cushion that is thicker than it needs to be, and if there is a potential here to give some relief in the tuition increase levels. Do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, first of all, as we talk about the growth in the ending balances, I think it will be really important to note the level at which those fund balances are already committed. I mean, just go back to that issue of cash flow. Those are dollars that, at a point in time, here's we'll say $111 million. Literally, $54 million will be spent on an average out of that. So you're then looking at an available amount of $50-60 million, whatever that might be, and that is then related to a budget of about $650 to $700 million. So you're now falling under the 10% level for an amount that may actually be available, I think, for, as you're suggesting, for a quote cushion.
Well, but on the other side of that discussion, you have money flowing into this according to when the students pay their tuition, which is several times a year. Has there been a cash flow analysis done for this month over month?
Madam Chair, we do have a cash flow. We've done a cash flow analysis.
I think it would be interesting for the members of the committee to see a month-by-month cash flow analysis of the balance in the account.
Madam Chair, we can do that. The one thing I would suggest, though, is if there may be other options that one looks at other than the governor's budget. And that's not intended to be a slight on the governor's budget, but if that doesn't happen, then the cash flow changes as our fund balances would change.
I understand that, but I think that what the committee would be looking for is relative information, not exact numbers. That I would be personally looking to see trends in the balance over the course of a year.
Madam Chair?
Representative Smith?
Even maybe 2 years.
2 years?
Just to give a little historical significance to it.
Is that possible?
Madam Chair, just more of a comment than a question, I guess. As I read through this, and your cash flow data should help us, I think you're looking at about a three-month ending balance when you get right down to it.
Yeah, that's right.
And that seems to be one of the prudent things we've been looking at as far as having a cash flow balance cover. I mean, we've done it with other agencies, and this is a bigger agency. The numbers are bigger. We need to look at that carefully, too. The other point is that there is a tendency, I think, in government budgets and in budgets in my business that if you don't spend it, you don't get to keep it. And every time that there's an ending balance that looks a little off somewhere, people have a tendency to say, let's take that away. And then the message to the agency and to the people involved is, well, we didn't spend it, so we lost it. Let's spend it next time. We don't want that message going out either. So this is a policy decision that we have to look at very carefully, understanding that we want prudence, we want careful budgeting, we don't want excessive tuition. But on the other hand, we're not asking those agents together to spend every penny they've got to make their ending balance look better. I don't want that happening either. So there's some push and shove here we have to look at from both sides.
Mr. McGee.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, Bill McGee from DASP. Speaking just to the $111 million number at this point, I think it would be prudent not to put a lot of emphasis on that right now. I think as we work with your staff and look at tuition rates that are being discussed, as you look at enrollment growth, you find a lot of that difference between the 73 and 111 is because really the structure of the governor's budget, where we really have revenue coming in for enrollment that is not necessarily matched at this point with expenditure limitation. So I think as you work through your recommendations from staff on that, I think you'll find that number probably will change pretty significantly. So I think if we can look at that again when we get to the next work session, I think we'll be able to provide a little more light on that whole issue.
Mr. Bender, perhaps then you should continue taking us through this.
Mm-hmm. There are, back on my summary sheet, actually, the one-page sheet, just to talk about some of the other fund balances that are in the Oregon University System accounts. They do maintain separate funds for each of the three statewide public service programs, Agricultural Experiment Station, Extension Service, and Forest Research Laboratory. And you can see the fund balances that are projected for each of these three statewide public service programs, again, under the governor's balanced budget proposal. These funds, what are in these funds, are primarily the federal monies and other monies that are combined with the general fund to support the programs of these three statewide public service programs. And again, the agency can comment as to their belief as to the adequacy of these levels of fund balances. But these are the projections we're seeing.
Mr. Anders?
Madam Chair, probably would be best for when you do speak to the statewide individually to get their viewpoint as well. We've had the discussion on extension, and we are assuming that the ending fund balance for 2003-5 will be lower than this. I think that's still to be determined. We've had discussions specifically with the Ag Experiment Station, and these seem to be reasonable. They've had larger fund balances. They've been expending those, but in a fairly planned and programmed way. And the Forest Research Lab, I believe, is pretty much on target as well.
Representative Senator Masery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have an analysis of how many months of operation these fund balances would cover?
Madam Chair, Senator Masery,
statewide.
Just one second here. We can get that. We did not do that specifically for them, but we can do that.
We have, as we've been going through the budgets of the other funded boards that this committee has jurisdiction over, we've been finding it very helpful to get a two-year month-by-month cash flow analysis, and that helps the committee, I think, clearly see the ebbs and flows in the balances of the funds. And so if it would be possible for you to prepare the same thing, I'm sure Mr. Bender could give you examples of what we've been looking at.
They actually have provided that to us. I just didn't distribute that. I didn't realize my apologies, but that was something you'd want to look at today.
Okay. Talk to us about auxiliary funds, Mr. Bender.
Auxiliary funds are a little different. These are funds, first of all, that are held by campuses, and these are the funds that are in the campuses hold for their various what we call auxiliary or self-support activities. These would include housing services, dining services, parking, student health services, and incidental fee supported services. All of these funds, all of these particular services receive no general fund support. So they operate on a self-support basis. If you add up all of these various funds amongst the campuses, you can see we're talking about $21 million. That's projected to increase to about $26 million. These funds, again, since these are not general fund-supported programs, if you were to consider using some of these funds to offset general fund costs, this would be a very substantial change in the way these programs have been financed. And what essentially you would be doing is you would be taking money that had been paid, for example, for residence fees, and transferring that money to the general fund. I mean, that's the type of activity that this would involve if you were to go there. So it would be a very substantial change in what these fees were used for.
I think I would like to see a cash flow of the last 2 years on this fund balance also.
Okay, we do have that as well.
Because I don't know how we can make any decisions until we look at it more closely, if we are making decisions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Masery.
As with all of these statewide and auxiliary funds, maybe even on the Education General Fund, it seems to me these are substantial increases, in some of the cases at least. And are the reserves too low at the beginning balance? And are they trying to build reserves? Or what is, as you said, also, what is the appropriate ending balance? But it seems to me like this is certainly a larger increase than what inflation would be that would be prudent for the ending balance, and And if part of it is due because of increased enrollment, that might be appropriate in some cases, but probably not in all. And so I'd just like to have some comfort level as to what is the appropriate level.
I would agree with you, Senator Mesley, that on a percentage basis, the difference between the beginning balances and the ending balances are substantial. And excluding the discussion that we've already had around the education in general account, can you talk to us, Mr. Anders, in the general sense, why the beginning balances, are these traditionally lower than they have been? And what's going on with the relationship between these two numbers?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, on the auxiliary funds specifically, again, there has been a lot of growth in enrollment, and that enrollment is what directly impacts the auxiliaries. You're talking about more students in dining halls and in residence halls and student activity centers. That is the primary force behind that. And it's really important to know that with auxiliaries, they have to maintain funding for all of their renovations, everything that they can do in a residence hall, in a dining hall, student athletic facilities, is derived solely from these dollars. So that if they can't go, as an example, and get a general fund for anything if they have a problem. So they should actually have higher reserves, if for nothing else, not only for the basic contingent purposes, but also for the fact that they have to plan to buy major equipment and renovations out of those same dollars. It's not a separate pot that sits off on a side. The growth, I think, has been planned in the sense that all of the institutions over the last 3 years have been making a real honest attempt at meeting the demand that's out there. So I think we're looking at planned growth that leads to, frankly, planned growth in the reserves to meet what will be a growing student body.
Well, how do you apply that concept then to the fund balances in the statewide programs?
Madam Chair, I can't. In that particular instance, you're talking about generally for federal dollars. They may well be gaining more access to federal grants. They may be looking down the road and saying, you know, we're gonna hold back some of our dollars and be able to invest and grow some of their fund balances. Actually, part of the issue with the Extension Service was that there was a point in time where they had maintained a fairly large level of fund balances, and I think at one point they were saying it was around $7 million. And now it's down to three and probably will be lower than that by the end of 2003-5. Their intent was to purposely hold that and then identify specific programs and initiatives and say, we're going to invest in this generally where there was more federal dollars, be able to grow it, but use the reserves for those purposes. It's not like an operating reserve on a month-to-month basis in those particular instances.
And looking at the backup information that's available for the ending balance in the Extension Service budget, it doesn't appear that it took a jump in 2001. But from what I recall from earlier testimony, the federal funds are held at a federal level and aren't reflected in the ending balance.
I don't know.
Madam Chair, the dollars that they've received, they will have received dollars from the federal government that would be part of their fund balance. There's commitments from the federal government where they may not have received the dollars yet, but there are also dollars that they will have received that would be part of a fund balance, and those can grow up or down based on their contractual obligations.
Well, and I would assume that those are dollars that essentially they've been able to draw on, but I recall the discussion around the hot water that they got themselves in was, and the reason that it fell through your audit cracks was that the federal dollars weren't in your bookkeeping system, they were in the federal system.
Madam Chair, I remember that conversation, and I think it had to do with them actually reporting the dollars that they were receiving. Had they reported those, they would have been part of the system. But they had not reported them, and apparently internally hadn't monitored them, which is why I think at the point that they were actually expending them at a higher level, they didn't realize that.
Okay. I do think it would be helpful for the committee members to see that month-over-month cash flow.
How do you do, Barry?
Yeah, let's continue on with where you're taking us with this, Mr. Bender.
Could I ask one question?
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Martin.
No problem. On the auxiliary funds, do we have some sort of a ballpark of what maybe deferred maintenance might be for the student housing, for the computer equipment that's bought, and i.e., what is going to be the demand out there for this reserve?
Madam Chair and Representative March, we do have that because we have a fairly comprehensive review of all of the deferred maintenance needs. I'm not sure about equipment, long-term equipment needs, but at this exact moment, I want to say that it is in the range of $200 million for the auxiliaries. But I really need to verify that, and it does make a good point, though.
Right.
Well, Representative Smith? I mean, if you want to justify your ending balance, I think you need to make a better case than you have so far. I would like to see, you know, the age of these structures you're talking about. When was the last repair done? What you plan for the future? What the growth demands are going to be? Because, you know, you're asking us to make decisions when we don't have adequate information, and I don't really hear it forthcoming, just like the month-to-month cash flow situation. We need to look at that and study it before we can make any decisions. You know, for instance, if you're going to rebuild the dyeing facility at Oregon State University over the next several years because you expect growth. Growth to me means wear and tear on structures. You know, I need to know what that is specifically.
Mr. Bender.
I just wanted to clarify that LFO, when we come back with our recommendations for you, you know, consistent with the new co-chair's budget and any changes that may be in there, we'll be looking at these balances in the education in general and statewide public services to see to what extent they're available to help support the costs in the upcoming biennium. In the situation for the auxiliary funds, I do want to remind committee members that these budgets are non-limited and that the legislature isn't indicating how much can be spent in these programs. This is how this has been operating as long as I've known, and therefore these fund balances are, I think it's important to note that these fund balances exist in these auxiliary functions, but that these functions are expected to be operating on a self-support basis, and the legislature has not even been indicating how much can be spent in these various operations as long as they are maintained on a self-support basis.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, just a couple of quick questions so I understand the figures better. The 201, 203 auxiliary, other funds limited auxiliary, is this what we're talking about? Just so I understand this, the beginning balance in June 30, 2001 was $30 million. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And the ending balance had dropped to $20 million. The ending balance for 03 is the beginning balance for 03-05.
That is correct.
So they dropped from 30 to 20, but in the next biennium, if I'm reading this correctly, you expect the $20 million beginning balance to, when we reach the 05 end, according to the next column over, to be $46 million. Is that correct?
To be $26 million.
$26 million.
Yes. That's the information we're receiving.
The 03-05 ending balance should be $26 million?
$26 million.
No. Yes. Whoa. You see, the $20 million, if you look at the other sheet that I provided, at the bottom there, the beginning balance is the $20.7 million figure that you see there in the second column. The ending balance figure was something that I calculated based on the projected cash flow for the auxiliaries. It's not on this sheet, the larger sheet, which is provided directly by OUS.
So the figure I'm seeing, the largest sheet, the fourth column over, the projected ending cash balance of $46 million is well below that amount. That's not the correct figure, or am I just reading that wrong?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're looking at $46 million. I don't know what that $46 million is, actually, now that you mention that.
Perhaps we could have Mr. Anders?
It should have been $26 million.
Are you tracking with where Representative Gates is?
On the large sheet, funds limited auxiliaries, fourth column over, last line, objected in cash balance of $46 million, well below the amount of the previous sentence. But what I'm thinking was that $46 million, and is that the ending cash balance for 0305? Or am I just reading this wrong?
I think what we're looking at is the difference between the fund balance and the cash balances. If I'm following.
Yeah, I think the $46 million is really, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I apologize for trying to track with this here a bit. The $46 million, according to my spreadsheet here, that ending balance should be $40 million in cash at the end of this biennium. So I know where cash and fund balances are becoming somewhat mixed up here, I think.
Madam Chair, let me discuss this off. We'll not have the committee time taken up because I don't understand the figures, and that wouldn't be the first time. But once you explain to me, I usually get it, so I don't want to take any more time up. The other question I have is, in the last when we were going through this in the last go-around with e-board in 0103, we had a real difficulty with tuition being capped, fund being capped, and then energy fees and some other fees being added in an attempt to balance some of those budgets. Where would the energy fees and those kind of fees that were added in show in this spreadsheet? Is it in auxiliaries? Is it in the general fund? Where would those monies be?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that would be in your ENG. It would be the tuition and fees.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I would also caution the committee about getting into too detailed of a discussion on the balance levels and auxiliary funds, being as this is not an area that we're going to end up being able to exercise control over. Mr. Bender.
That completes the information on the fund balances. I would note that even though on my summary sheet I didn't include this, on the back of the larger sheets you can see there are additional fund balances that are restricted from federal sources and other sources. And there are the amounts there, but those funds would not be available for purposes other than for which they were received.
Mr. Bender, I would note that from the original information that we got out of the state's accounting system, that the fund balances that are listed here are quite different.
Yes.
Can you talk to us about the process that you went through with the system to reconcile to these numbers?
We've basically been in conversations with the system to assure that we can get the most accurate information available for the committee. And we've had, they have been with some revisions in the numbers as they've gone through and looked at the information that is in their accounting system. But these are the current numbers that they have in their accounting systems that we're presenting to you here.
So was there a process entered into where, I'm still concerned about the level of the discrepancy, and if there was a discussion about why the numbers were different in the process of arriving at these numbers?
Frankly, not really. We haven't had time to go into that, but we just wanted to make sure that we were getting the accurate numbers for you. But we don't, I have not had a discussion of the. I do not have a complete understanding of why the original set of numbers were not the numbers that we're seeing now.
Mr. Anders.
Madam Chair, what we did when we got the numbers, we looked at them and looked at what was in our system, and we went through where we saw were seven or eight areas of potential difference in terms of what may well be in orbits and both when that is in there, how it's adjusted, and what the specific dollars are, and we looked then at our system, we found three or four differences in terms of the timing, in terms of whether or not capital was included in that or not. And a third one, which may have been the bigger one of all of these, was to do with whether or not a system, when there were changes that the state system was changed, in 2001, 2002, whether there were various changes made that would continue to roll forward. And if they weren't, then those balances would just continue to grow. And we think that was another problem. That's something that I'll be working with.
I'm not understanding what you're saying. Can you try to talk to me about that again?
Madam Chair, there are adjustments that would be made during a year that were not necessary, that would be made, and I can't think of an example, a specific example of an adjustment.
Audit adjustments after year end, after the loading of the Orbitz information.
I didn't hear what you said.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. We have our fiscal audit every year that ends probably in October, and those adjustments that are made for audit purposes have not been reflected in the balances in Orbitz. That's one of the things. One of the major differences is that Orbitz would include entire capital construction appropriations that have been or limitations that have been legislatively approved for a project that may be multi-year, and that's included in that number, which in our number would not be because it's not a balance that's available for use. So that's my understanding that those are a couple of the specific differences between the numbers.
Through the process of trying to reconcile both of the accounting systems, have you made any changes in the way that you're going to work with the state system?
Madam Chair, of course, the budget note directs a link that we're going to begin working with the governor's office and LFO to begin the linkage of those in a more tighter manner.
So, with your familiarity with the accounting system in the OUS system that relates to these funding reserves, is the information that we have here the extent of all of the reserve funds? Are there any other reserve funds that aren't taken into consideration in this information that we have?
Representative Morgan, there are statutory equipment and building reserves relative to auxiliary enterprise funds that are not shown in this information, wasn't requested of us. Those are statutorily set aside to do a certain equipment replacement and building repair. Trying to think.
We've got the student loans,
endowment fund, endowment funds as well, that are funds that have been donated to the university in an endowment sense, to where the earnings then come into the E&G program to fund E&G activities that are part of the revenue stream. And then, like you say, student loan fund.
Because they're included.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in terms of funds that have a component of either tuition or general fund, are there other funds besides these?
Madam Chair, no, there are not.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Mr. Bender?
The last item that we do have for you is just a review or an indication of the items that are in the co-chair's budget, the adjustments from the governor's balanced budget that are included in the co-chair's budget. I'm sure you've seen these in different formats before, but I just wanted to run these by you again to see that the types of reductions that are in there include reductions to cell values, which are found in the first row there, a 6% reduction in funding for undergraduate education cell values, which is equivalent to a $21.9 million reduction. Then if you go about halfway down this list, you'll see a $9.7 million amount for a similar proportional reduction in graduate cell funding. Those would be items that, if you approve these reductions as they are in the co-chair's budget, the system would, under the principles that they've indicated to you, they would reduce proportionally the enrollments that are the number of FTE enrollments that they are funding in the system and maintain the funding per enrolled student at the 72% level. The other items represent reductions to various targeted programs in the RAM. We had some discussion in detail as to those targeted programs yesterday, but you can see there are a number of reductions here to targeted programs. There's fee remission equity, collaborative programs, partnerships, et cetera. There's also, I've indicated in the comments column, comments for two of these reductions that are in the general, that are in the co-chair's budget. In situations for all of the other items where you don't see a particular comment, what these reductions are the reductions, if you look on the second page, you asked higher ed to provide you with their priority list and to what they would propose if they were required to take general fund reductions from the governor's level, where they would propose having those reductions made. And essentially those items on the prior page here where there's no comment are consistent with the 6% cut level. So what the co-chair's budget has in it is it essentially has the 6% cut level that the department has indicated would be their preference of reductions at that same dollar level of cuts, if they had to take that same dollar level of cuts, plus the changes that are indicated on the in the comments column for two items. In terms of the chancellor's office and campus administrative reductions, co-chairs have an $8 million reduction in there, which is actually $5.6 million above the 6% cut that you see on the second page. So that is one adjustment that is different from what the straight 6% reduction that the university proposed. The other change is a reduction in programmatic fee remissions of $30 million. The concept behind that is that the institutions would be expected that $30 million in general fund would be taken out of the system with the expectation that by reducing programmatic fee remissions, the net revenues that would be available from tuition and fees would increase by that $30 million. So they would reduce the fee remissions by $30 million. We show in this table, we always show the cuts as positive numbers and the restorations as negative numbers. I know that's confusing, but that's the way we put these tables together for the co-chairs to look at. So basically, that's a $30 million, it's a fund shift of $30 million away from general fund onto tuition revenues, where the additional tuition revenues would be realized not by increasing the base tuition rate, but by limiting the amount of fee remissions that are reducing tuition revenues. That is not in the OUS proposal at all. And I know that there will be more discussions on that. You have received, we've been getting information as to the commitments, the legal commitments that exist for programmatic fee remissions in instances where they were multi-year awards were committed to. And it may be that this $30 million would not even be entirely doable without violating multi-year commitments that have already been entered into. So we'll be getting more information on that and seeing whether this is a policy that the subcommittee, you know, wishes to support or not in any event.
Mr. Bender, have we received information from the system on the attrition rate in the tuition remission program?
They are planning to provide some additional information on that. Fundamentally, the type of attrition that they have been projecting till now is basically a 20% attrition in multi-year fee remissions each year. So in other words, if $1,000 in fee remissions are awarded for a multi-year period, they would assume that $800 would still be needed the following year, $600 the year after that, $400 the year after that, and $200 in the fifth year, because these multi-year commitments are for a five-year period. But they are getting additional information for LFO to review on that. Of course, to the extent that a student doesn't complete the five-year period, they don't continue with their studies, that would also affect the attrition rate, and that's not specifically in the types of projections that OUS has been using.
Thank you. Questions? Representation of puzzle.
Well, I have a discussion with LFO privately because I don't take it too many time for something I don't quite completely understand, so I'm sure Steve can get me up to speed.
Okay. Any more information you want to leave with us?
We have no more information for you today.
Do you have any information on our schedule? I noticed we got an email this morning from you.
Yes, there you have one bill scheduled for tomorrow, a public hearing and work session on an education-related bill. There is an email at your office with the appropriate bill number, and we will not be doing the bill that we originally had said that we would be doing on Monday to deal with supplemental limitations for the Department of Education. That's not ready to go. But there will be an education bill tomorrow, and Sue McGlashan will be here tomorrow to work with you on it.
Committee members, needless to say, not a controversial bill. So I don't anticipate that we'll be in committee for an extended period of time.
But we need a quorum.
That is a good point. We would definitely need a quorum.
And
Mr. Bender.
Next week, we will be starting the community college budget. And I do wish to talk to the chair a little bit about the timing on that, but we will get information out to your offices tomorrow with that schedule.
And with that, we will close the work session and adjourn the committee.